Of course, our yearly show here for the Joe Torre Safe at Home Foundation, their annual Celebrity Golf and Tennis Classic. We should have some special guests along the way as well, but I know Joe will be joining us in just about 10 minutes or so as we get things started here on the BT and Sal Show, BT on vacation, so it's just you and me. And our friends at Town Fair Tire remind you that at Town Fair Tire, you always get the guaranteed lowest price on name brand tires from Connecticut to Maine. Nobody beats Town Fair Tire. Nobody. Now that the all-star nonsense has come and gone, although I will be asking Mr. T about that in just a few minutes, we can focus on the second half of the season, and we can turn our attention to what these teams need to do to get better here. And when we talk about, okay, the players underperforming or question the managers, well, now, where we are 2 weeks ahead of the trade deadline, the focus is going to solely be on both Brian Cashman and David Stearns, and really the owners as well. It's the front offices now that will be evaluated on how aggressive they will be in trying to complete these clubs and turn them each into legitimate World Series contenders. How aggressive are they going to go? And when I say aggressive, there are multiple ways to be aggressive. Number one would be trading the prospects, right? How much are you... You could say, oh, we're going to go all in, or whatever the exact term, I keep forgetting it was, with Cashman used. But basically, he said that they're going to go all in. Okay, well, we'll see. Does all in mean George Lombard Jr.? Does all in mean Spencer Jones? And I know they're not each equal, but you get the point. That, to me, would be all in, where the Yankees have not been all in. They could say that they're going to be aggressive, and they can make big moves like they did a year ago with Jazz Chisholm, and I fully expect that Brian Cashman will be aggressive, but to what extent, I'm not so sure that he would be willing to give up the top prospects. Now, you're not just giving guys away. It's going to be in a spot where you believe that they could be the final fit, whether that's Suarez at third base or whoever else they believe could be the third baseman, whether it's a legit lockdown, no doubt about it, power arm in the bullpen, which is what the Yankees need. They need a power arm. They have guys, whether it be Williams or Weaver out of the pen, but outside of Cam Schlittler, and we still got to learn about him, Yankees don't have a power arm, period, on their staff. So not only in the bullpen would that help, they could probably use one in the rotation and lengthen that out a little bit. And you have the Mets, who may be looking for the same thing. Center field a little bit different, but they could also potentially use a third baseman. And they certainly need the bullpen arms and could use a depth piece as well. So we have both these teams fighting in the offseason for Juan Soto, and we will have both these teams fighting for players to improve their ball club ahead of the deadline just 2 weeks from today. And both teams, the Yankees are in a different boat, because I was going to use the term both teams survived. Obviously, the Mets survived and weathered the storm because we weren't sure that the Mets were going to be able to uphold that. The Mets don't have the resume, the track record that the Yankees do. So even as bad as it got for the Yankees, getting swept by the Blue Jays, losing 2 out of 3 to the Mets, falling out of first place, you still know the floor for the Yankees is going to be postseason. They'll be right there in the division. I still think they're going to win the division. But you never really got that concerned about the floor. You know that there were flaws there with their team, but you weren't concerned about the floor. With the Mets, it was, uh-oh, could they be going in the wrong direction and taking on too much water? How are they going to survive this? And they were able to do that. And now that we've reached the break and both teams survived and are in good spots in the standings, obviously you'd like them both be in first place, but right there with the division in striking distance and the postseason should be a foregone conclusion, although you just never completely know. Now it's about, okay, here we are, 2 weeks to go to improve our ball club and put the finishing touches on what should have been World Series contending teams anyway, but now you really want to take it to the next level. We trust that Cashman will be aggressive, but will he give up the prospects, the top prospects, if need be? Will Hal be willing to take on money, if need be? We know, see, it's funny, with the Yankees, we know Cashman's going to want to be aggressive, it's just to what extent with the prospects. And then the other question is, well, how much money will Hal take on? Whereas with the Mets, we know Steve Cohen will be willing to take on money, if need be. Whatever that may be. I don't know. Pick a guy. Severino. Yeah, we'll take on Severino. We're not going to give any prospects for him, but we'll take his contract off your hands if you're the A's. We know Cohen has shown a willingness to do that, where Hal has been less inclined to do so. So we know that about Cohen, but we don't know that about David Stearns. His definition of aggressive may be different from what we think is aggressive. But the Mets certainly have the prospects, whether it's Beatty or Mauricio or Vientos, just at the big league level, not to mention the guys at the minor league level, where there are, this seems to be the perfect time for the Mets to strike. They need to add to this ball club to put the finishing touches on what could be a World Series contender, and they have an abundance of guys who play the same position, and there's just no room for, not only this year, but moving forward. Can't get everybody in. You're not going to be able to get Beatty at-bats, and Vientos, and Mauricio, and McNeil, and Jett Williams. Like, it's not just about this year. It's about also projecting forward, too, when they bring some of these guys in, or bring some of these guys up. So there's a lot going on as far as that goes, where maybe David Stearns would be willing to part with some of those guys, some name prospects, to get better now for pieces that fit better, whether it be a bullpen piece, whether it be a depth piece in the starting rotation, or whether it be a legitimate center fielder. I'm not sure Cedric Mullins, to me, fits that bill anymore. Maybe he's the best available with Buxton off the table because he's not going to waive his no-trade clause. I don't know. Maybe Stearns got something else up his sleeve. But point is, both these general managers in completely different spots in their careers, in their tenures. Cashman's been here forever, and the knock has been, well, you haven't delivered a World Series since 2009. Been a long time. And with Stearns, it's, okay, well, yeah, you come from the Brewers and that small payroll mentality, and last year wasn't overly aggressive. Some nice moves, but need to be aggressive. And the Mets also, you know, still kind of hurt from the lack of aggression or big-time moves in 2022, missing an opportunity, costing themselves a division, which in turn cost themselves in the postseason with the quick exit in the wild card round. This has to be the year. And we could go over Cashman's moves or reluctance to deal with top prospects that could have been game changers, whether it be Volpe for Castillo or so on, all the, you know, holding on to Spencer Jones for Corbin Burns last year, all those different things that Cashman has done in recent history. Well, it's a new year. But both these general managers are going to be scrutinized here for the next 2 weeks because it should be a year where both teams legitimately go out there and try to win a World Series. I know the Yankees try to do it every year, but their try and our try could be different. If you're going all in, truly all in, and the right deal presents itself, the perfect deal presents itself, then you better be willing to give up the prospects or be willing to take on the money or do both if necessary. And I'm not sure I trust the Yankees just yet. I need to see it to do both. Trade the top prospects and take on more money. And with the Mets, I trust half of the equation. They will take on money if it's the right move. Cohen will do that. He's done that in the past. The prospects part of it, I don't know. And then you take it to a whole other level where not only do they need to be aggressive and take on money or part with prospects or both, then, and this is the real key, you have to decide which prospects to part with and which guys are going to be the right guys to bring in, whether it be take on money or whatever the case may be. All right, BT and Sal on the Fan, BT on vacation. We are live here at the Joe Torre Safe at Home annual Celebrity Golf and Tennis Classic. It's been going on, obviously, for a long time. We've been happy to be partners with them. More than 20 years ago, Joe and his wife, Allie, founded Safe at Home to end the cycle of violence and abuse through education. They sought out to create a world where every young person feels safe, supported, and empowered. The values of positive role modeling, leadership, teamwork, and respect Joe modeled throughout his baseball career. It's been their mission. And Safe at Home's groundbreaking Margaret's Place program, named in honor of Joe's beloved mother, creates safe spaces in schools to provide intervention and prevention services to students who are impacted by violence and abuse. It is an honor to welcome to the show Mr. Joe Torre. Joe, how you doing today?
Sal, how are you?
Yeah, not bad. You're fresh off an All-Star appearance. How'd it feel to have the uniform back on?
You know, it goes back 2 years ago. I was going around in spring training with MLB, and we always meet with all the teams, and, you know, I'm sort of a spectator in that. And then I get a call from Aaron Boone. I'm in Arizona, and I thought he butt-dialed me or something, and I called back. And he says, "Are you planning on visiting us?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going to stop by." He says, "How about putting on the uniform?" And I said, "Thank you, but no, you know, I'm not interested." Well, when I went to visit, I'm sitting in with the coaches, you know, Guidry and Willie Randolph, and he really wanted me to, put the uniform on, and I wound up putting the uniform on. And, you know, my feeling was, you know, I don't, I know what spring training's about. I know the manager has a lot on his, you know, plate, and I just didn't want to be in the way, only because I know how much work goes into it. So he convinced me, and then the players were very welcoming, and that was pretty cool. So I spent, you know, 3 or 4 days, and then I did it again this past spring. And then when I was sitting there in the dugout this past spring, and Booney sits next to me, he says, how would you like to be a coach for me in the All-Star game? And I said, well, let me check with the powers to be, because I don't want to violate anything. He says, I've already done that. I said, oh, okay. And I was, you know, I was a little off guard, you know, but I was excited about it, and it was fun. It really, the game itself was dynamite, and you know, hanging with the players. And the one thing, Sal, that I you know, came to terms with was the fact that the players, you know, obviously I was with the American League team in the clubhouse and the day before, you know, and working out, and I think the game's in good hands. Let's put it that way, and that made me feel good.
So making the pitching change, going out there in front of the Atlanta crowd, which I know obviously you were there a long time with the Atlanta Braves, player, manager, all that stuff there. How did that feel to be a part of the Hank Aaron celebration? Did that make it even more special to have the uniform on a night like that in Atlanta?
Yeah, I mean, my career started with the Braves, you know, and I was a member of the Milwaukee Braves when we moved to Atlanta in 66. And you know, it always feels right, because that's where it all started for me. And my brother played with the Milwaukee Braves before I did, and so it was something I was comfortable with. And of course, Hank Aaron, you know, batting behind him for 8 years was pretty special to do. And but the fact that it was Atlanta, and I played in an All-Star game in Atlanta in the original ballpark, and then I managed an All-Star game in Turner Field, and then I was able to coach at their new Truist Park. So it was pretty special for me.
And if memory serves correct, you won some pretty big World Series games down there as a manager as well in Atlanta.
Yeah, well, you know, it was crazy. 96, you know, we lose the two at home, and then we go down there and sweep them in their ballpark. And then when we faced them in 99, we opened on the road and we beat them the two games there. And don't ask me how it happens, except that, you know, we're a pretty good road team in those postseason games.
All right, so tell me about the foundation here. I got plenty of other stuff I want to get into, specifically with the All-Star game that took place a couple nights ago. But where are we at with the foundation? Happy with the way everything's been going for over 20 years now?
Well, I'm happy that, we're reaching these kids. We know what we do with Margaret's Place, which she named after my mom, and it's a safe room in schools, and we have a master's level counselor. You know, our society now, I think it's more necessary with prevention than ever before. I mean, role models are so important for us. But, you know, we're fortunate. We got 30 programs. You know, we're on the West Coast. We're on the East Coast. We have one program in Cincinnati. And believe it or not, we have two in Tahiti.
Hmm.
So, you know, you know, have over 20,000 kids a year that come in contact with our program, and you know, I think it's just too important not to have it.
Is this something you're just going to continue doing the rest of your life?
I hope so. I hope beyond that. You know, to me, because of the program and because of how important, especially in nowadays, where, you know, we need to make sure that we have role models out there for these kids, and let them know, say if domestic violence is going on in their home, you know, that just because it's the only male role model you may have doesn't mean you do the same thing. And you just want to put kids in a good place, because there's so many kids that come in, and I was one of them. I had the good fortune of having the ability to play baseball, so I had a place to hide from what was going on in my home. But you know, these kids come in and they don't have that self-esteem. And if you send them out in society nowadays, there are some bad people out there. You know, somebody will put their arm around them, say, come with me, you know, and maybe give them some money, and all of a sudden they're trusting somebody they shouldn't trust. So, you know, we feel very good about what we do and how the kids leave our program. So we hope we can sustain this and then, you know, hand it off to the next group of people that will continue this for whenever.
I think it's an incredibly important cause, and you guys have done a great job with it for over 20 years. Like you said, we're honored to be a part of it and be a continued partner with you with this. Okay, so the All-Star Game, Jeter, you caught up with him. What's your relationship like with Derek currently? I know he famously calls you Mr. T. He's doing the broadcasting now. You keep in touch with him a lot. It looked like you guys were exchanging pleasantries down there on the field before the game. Where's your relationship at with Jeter?
You know, it's we don't obviously stay in touch every day or every week, but when you do stay in touch, it's like it's supposed to be this way. You know, I had the same relationship with Bob Gibson. You know, once you know we stopped playing together and stuff, but it's very warm, it's very comfortable. He'll always check in on me, and I'll do the same. You know, because he's got a big family now, and you know, he likes his life, and I'm happy for him, and he does a good job, obviously. Whatever he would do, I'm a little biased, but whatever he would do a good job because he cares a great deal about it.
All right, I hit you with the softballs. Now I got to get into it here.
Fire away.
I've been critical of Major League Baseball the last couple of days, and I'll give you the 2 points why. Number one, and your special assistant is still Commissioner Manfred and all
that
stuff.
I'm not. I don't have that position. What I do now is I'm still connected. And if Rob, can't be two places at one time, I'll go to the other place. But as they said in The Few Good Men, I have absolutely no responsibility whatsoever.
Okay, so I'll take it easy on you.
No. Okay. Fire away. I still have an opinion on things.
How the hell is Juan Soto not representing baseball at the All-Star Game? Come on, Mr. T. He's a huge star. He's got the numbers. Yankees in the World Series a year ago. Signs with the Mets with the mega contract. All the numbers back it up. Don't you think it would benefit the sport to figure out a way to get Juan Soto with the All-Star Game?
Yes.
And how was he not there?
I don't know, but you can go from city to city and, you know, they have the same argument. I mean, Philadelphia, they had a couple of pitchers who were overlooked that have done a great job.
But they're not Juan Soto.
Well, I understand that. No, so I'm a Juan Soto fan. I got to know him a little bit not this past spring, the spring before, and he was with the Yankees. He's got a great personality. He may be one of the best hitters I've ever seen in the game. He doesn't swing and miss very often. I haven't got an answer. Did he deserve to be, with his numbers and just his presence,
biggest market,
which is what you're talking about? Did he have, deserve to be there? Sure.
Well, we're trying to grow the game. You would think it would benefit them by having one of the big stars there.
Yeah, again, but there are other players beside him, and I know it's a big market. It's New York and all that stuff, and I can't disagree with anything you're saying, Sally, but I manage in six All-Star games, and trust me, everybody, in spite of the excitement of managing, you're always going to have somebody saying you shortchanged me here or there, and that's what it amounted to.
We talked about this yesterday. Actually, I had Terry Collins on the show. David Wright having his numbers retired this weekend with the Mets, so we were talking about this a little bit, and he managed the All-Star game in 2016. Obviously, you managed many All-Star games with all the years your Yankees were in the World Series and winning most of them, as a matter of fact. But it's different now where Boone's not picking the players, right? The voting is from the players. Obviously, the fans vote in for the starters. Then the players are voting, I guess, in large part with the reserve players. You like the way the voting system is at right now? I guess there's no perfect way. Where are you at with the voting system?
I was saying to Booney, it's not as much fun for you as it was for me. I mean, as simple as that. Because I had a lot, as manager, you had a lot more say. And now it's like, as you say, the fans, they'll vote for the starting lineup. And you get to place some opinions. There's no question you can do that. But, you only have so much of a roster. You know, Booney, I think, still had a good time. And this whole thing about my changing pitchers was really funny because it just came about. He says, Joe, he said, you willing to go out there? Because this Smith is going to come in. As soon as he gets an out, I'm going to go get him. I said, sure. I said, if I fall down halfway, come get me, man. But, no, it's exciting for me. I mean, I went out to the mound to take the pitcher out, and I looked around, and there's Bobby Witt Jr. and all these guys standing there. And I said, you know, I haven't done this for years, guys. And it was great. I really appreciated what Booney did for me, and you know, it was a fun time.
Do the current players understand your impact on the game, or you think that they're too young? I mean, some of these guys are 20 years old. You were having great success with the Yanks 30 years ago.
That's a good question, because I didn't know that, and you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, Skugel comes up to me and wants to introduce himself and guys, and it felt good. Yeah, I mean, it's good for my ego, but again, you know, it's still that question. I didn't know. I remember when I was a manager, and John Kruk came up to me, and because when you're a manager, they think you were born and became a manager. They don't think you played the game. John Kruk came up to me. He says, you know, you're a pretty good player. Which Krucky can only laugh, because he's such a good guy. And yeah, I mean, first of all, you know, I think players should be made aware of the history of our game, you know, because the game just didn't start. You know, it's been around a while, and there's some great history, and, you know, your bubblegum cards come to life. It did for me when I, you know, when Willie Mays came on the scene, I was 10 years old. Little did I know that 10 years later, I'm going to be trying to get him out. And but you meet these guys, and it never gets old.
God, that is insane. Like, even for me as a 45-year-old, I look at you primarily as the manager of the New York Yankees. I understand the history and you as a player, obviously, with the Mets as well. But to hear you say you hit behind Hank Aaron, or you were trying to get Willie Mays out. Joe, your connection, I mean, that's a pretty significant connection when you're talking about the greats like Mays and Aaron, and then through your playing years and through the Yankee dynasty to being able to make a pitching change in the 2025 All-Star game. Good God, hard-pressed to find somebody that's had the baseball life that you have had that's still around to talk about it.
You know, Booney said, do you want to say a few words to the players? I said, yeah, I would, you know, because Booney has his meeting. You know, as a manager, you have your meeting before the players go out to play. And I said, I want to give you a little background. I said, I played with the Braves. I played with the Cardinals. I played with the Mets. I managed the Mets. I managed the Braves. I managed the Cardinals. I was fired by all three of those teams. You know, give them a background, and just trying to be lighthearted, obviously, about it. And I told them how much I loved the game, and I wasn't about to quit, even though, you know, anytime you get fired, you realize somebody doesn't want you. Maybe you're not doing a good job. And, you know, and then I got this World Series ring that my brother had way before I did, when he was with the Braves in 57. And I just said the game always felt brand new to me, and it still does. And I'm thankful for that, because as far as I'm concerned, I never had to work a day in my life.
Incredible. All right, we're talking with Joe Torre live here at the Safe at Home Foundation, the annual Celebrity Golf and Tennis Classic. Two more for you, Mr. T, before mm-hmm. we let you go.
Sure.
On the heels of batting behind Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and all this stuff, where does Aaron Judge rank as far as the great players that you've seen?
Aaron Judge is, well, first of all, as an individual, you know, he has a lot of Derek Jeter in him for me. You know, it's not bells and whistles when he gets a hit. You know, it's something that he's paid to do, and just his approach to the game, where he doesn't try to pull the ball, even though obviously he does on occasions. But he uses the whole field, which to me is really a good sign hitting-wise. He's not going to be fooled. He's not afraid to let the ball get deep in there. And, you know, he strikes off, he strikes out, he walks away. But, you know, it's tough to not be fearful of this guy when he gets up to the plate. I don't see any weakness. And if he does have a spot, it's really tough for the pitcher to continue to exploit it.
Why do you think that there has been a drop-off from what he's done consistently in the regular season to a ridiculous level, maybe the greatest that the sport has ever seen, and then in the postseason just not matching?
You know what? You still have to understand, Sal, the human aspect. You know, everything speeds up. It's just like as a manager during the regular season, you lose, you know, five games in a row. That's okay. You know, we'll recover from that. In the postseason, I come to learn when I, you know, all of a sudden had this thing happen every year, one game, you know, all of a sudden puts you on the defensive, that the momentum is switched. So, you know, it's tough to catch up. So when you know people rely on you, and I haven't talked about Aaron about this, you know, when people rely on you and you have a responsibility, it means a lot. And I've seen Willie Stargell go through the same thing with the Pirates, you know, in the early 70s.
Schmidt struggled in the postseason.
You remember Gil Hodges back when, it went 0 for 20 or something. It's just the responsibility that these players carry that sometimes, you know, being human catches up with you.
You know, you made me think of something there. We were talking about, well, you lose five in a row, everything's going to be okay. You had George running things. Did you bust Booney's chops about Booney? You're all right. You could lose for three straight weeks. You're not going anywhere. Meanwhile, I had George breathing down my neck. You win four World Series in a row, and he still might want you out.
But, you know, George never scared me because I've been fired three times already. What's he going to do to me? Fire me? And I had a good relationship with George. I think we just had one disagreement. One time, I have to tell you this, because when we'd go bad, I'd call him up and kidding. I said, what am I doing wrong? You know, and I think they'd catch him off guard, and he'd say, you'll be all right. Don't worry about it. But I called him up one time, and he says, I wish you'd stop calling me because you have a way of talking me into things. But we had a good relationship. We had a good relationship. And, we talked about the first World Series in 96. I was excited about getting to the World Series. I had never been other than watching from the stands. And we get killed in the first game. Pettit gets roughed up, and you know Maddox is pitching the second game. And George comes into my office before game two. He says, "This is a must win." I said, "Yeah, I know." I said, "But we may lose today." And he looked at me, and I said, "Maddox is pitching. We hadn't played in a week because you know we clinched the previous Sunday, and this was the next Monday." And I said, we're flat and we haven't played. I said, we may even lose. Maddox pitching. Now I start messing with him. I said, but we're going to Atlanta. Yeah, I said, that's my town. We'll win three there for you and then come back and win the World Series on Saturday. And that's what happened. But I certainly didn't have a crystal ball. I just happened to mess with him. And, sometime later, I remember he repeated it to me. So I said, well, okay. He thought I was smart for some reason
right,
or other.
Right, now stay off my back a little bit. I just told you it was going to happen in the World Series. All right, swing off. Do you like it, the way that the All-Star game ended the other day with the swing off?
Initially, no. But again, you know, because I'm an old fuddy-duddy. You know, you play. Of course, I was the manager of the tie game in Milwaukee, don't forget.
Yeah, I do remember. I remember you and Bud looking at each other like, what the hell are we supposed to do here?
Well, I felt some responsibility because Bob Brenly, I had always mentioned, because I had done it before, to save a starter that, you know, you can talk to the starters before the game and get somebody to volunteer to be that guy in case you need a starter at the end in the tie game. And I never mentioned it to him, not that I kept from mentioning it to him. I forgot, and so his pitcher only had pitched Sunday, and he could only pitch one inning, and I had one that was fully rested the whole, you know, for five innings. So it just happened that, you know, we ran into a roadblock in that regard. It was embarrassing for Bud Selig, which I felt badly about, but having this home run thing at the end of the game, the players seem to like it. They all jumped out on the field. They're all pulling for the other guy. And, you know, okay. You know, and I shrugged. But it, it, it wasn't my thing because it's not baseball. But it was entertaining, and that's where we are at this point in time in the game of baseball.
A last one, I promise. Who would have gotten your vote for All-Star Game MVP?
Who would have gotten that? You know, depending on who won.
Well, okay, but the National League comes back and wins it with the swing-off. Schwarber did get it in
Schwarber,
that swing-off,
yeah.
Where you had Alonso hit the three-run.
Alonso hit the three-run homer. He stuck out for me. He really did. And then I watched Google. You know, he gave up three hits. I don't think he gave up three hits in his life in one inning.
Right.
But Alonso to me was the one that I would pinpoint on.
Yeah,
that.
Well, my only it was a talking point a little bit yesterday. And Mets fans, I know, were a little bit upset with that, but they gave the MVP to a guy who hit three home runs in the swing off against a batting practice pitcher,
right,
as opposed to Alonso hitting a three run homer in the game off an All Star. I mean, there's a big difference there.
Yeah, but what have you done for me lately? and that's where we are. You know, we want instant gratification on what happens right now. And, you know, I had no trouble with Schwarber because I really enjoy the way he plays the game. When he first caught my attention with the Cubs, and he's a leader type guy, and I'm happy for him, even though he probably would turn it over to Alonso if you asked him.
Joe, it's always a pleasure and honor to sit here and talk baseball with you, a true legend. So for me, it's an honor, and we're happy to be a part of this great cause. Joe Torre, Safe at Home, annual Celebrity Golf and Tennis Classic, a great charity. We look forward to having some of your former players on here and everybody else that you got here. But have a great day, and we do appreciate it, and best of luck with everything.
Sal, WFAN has been wonderful to us, and we really appreciate your presence here. And as far as our foundation, joetorre.org, they get all the information they want, and I really appreciate your presence here, guys. Thank you.
Hey, you invite us, we're going to be here. We promise that. That's
cool.
Joe Torre. We'll take a quick break, come back, get your calls in, 888-808-1019, Sal Licata. We were just talking to Mike Massimino, who is apparently, now I'm not familiar with this stuff, but apparently an astronaut who is also a Mets fan, which is more important than the astronaut stuff. But now Mike, excuse me here, I'm not familiar. Like, I think it's cool. I've never talked to a real-life astronaut before.
Okay.
So, we appreciate you
it's
listening.
It's all uphill from here.
Yeah.
Joe, might be the last one.
Mr. Torre just introduced me to Mike, and you tell me some of the stories here. Dude,
yeah.
Okay. So, now I have some, like, rudimentary basic
stuff. Sure, man.
Stuff.
Whatever you don't know.
Well, first, how did you get to meet Joe Torre?
Well, I'm a huge baseball fan, just like you, Sal.
Okay.
I grew up. I'm a bit older, so I remember the 69 Mets. I remember landing on the moon and the Mets winning the World Series in the same year, and that set my – I was 6 years old when that happened, and that's always been my two passions is baseball, particularly the Mets and spaceflight, right? And I grew up to be an astronaut. I couldn't hit a curveball, so I grew up to be an astronaut.
Yeah, two totally different things.
Yeah,
totally
different
Mets fan,
things.
Being an astronaut. Okay, spaceflight.
Yeah. And then Joe came down for a tour. He was managing the Dodgers in 09, and he had met one of my colleagues, a Yankee fan named Garrett Reisman from New Jersey, who's also a big baseball fan. So they got to know each other, and Joe came in for a tour, and I was part of that tour, and I got to meet him and some of the other folks with the Dodgers, and we immediately became friends.
So you grew up, where are you from originally?
Franklin Square, New York,
okay.
From Long Island. That's where I grew up, just outside of the city.
And then you had to move to Houston?
Yeah, well, you know, I went to school, college, grad school, moved around the country a little bit, but I lived in Houston for over 20 years, yeah, as an astronaut. That's where you live
now,
when you're doing
okay,
that.
Okay, but you loved being an astronaut, or you wanted to be an astronaut long before that, too.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have
an
issue, like, when the Mets were playing the Astros in 86? Who to root for?
No.
See,
I was in grad school then.
Okay.
I'm a Mets fan. I would go to all the games when the Mets were playing the Astros down in Houston. Used to be only like three games a year, right?
They'd
come in for one look at them, and I would go to all those games. So there's no conflict. I'm a Mets fan.
Well, yeah. I understood, but like
and the Astros, I rooted for because they were the local team.
You were an astronaut. I feel like if I wanted to be an astronaut, maybe I'd root for the Houston Astros.
I would also say this, Sal, is that the Astros were really very supportive of the space program. When we had our accident, we had a space shuttle accident. They all wore the shuttle patch. So I got to know a lot of the folks in that organization and some of the players, and we'd go there quite often. They had me throw a pitch out at one of their games, and they're a great organization. But, hey, you know, when push comes to shove, you know, I would go with the Mets.
All right, so which we respect, of course.
Yeah.
We're talking about Mike Massimino. So the way to label you is like real-life astronaut, right?
Former NASA, if you want to be official, former NASA astronaut.
Former NASA astronaut.
Right.
So you're talking to somebody who's afraid of heights.
So am I. I don't like heights either.
But What, you went to outer space?
A lot of astronauts don't like heights, Sal. It's you know what it is? It's not, you're not really afraid of height. What you're afraid of is gravity. Because you're afraid of falling off of something, right? If you're looking over the edge of a cliff or
right.
a building or a bridge, I don't like any of that stuff.
Okay.
But as long as I'm moving, like in an airplane, I'm fine.
Right? What about a roller coaster?
Roller coaster I'm okay with, too.
Okay, because you're moving.
I think as long as you're moving and it makes sense what you're doing, it's okay. It's just like looking over the edge of a building, you know, that kind of thing I don't like doing.
What type of rigorous training? Is there rigorous training to be an astronaut? Take me through it a little bit.
Yeah, so it's an interesting combination, I think, Sal. It's kind of like, you know, book stuff you have to learn, like you're in school. This is how the spaceship works. This is how the spacesuits work.
So you have to be book smart first.
Some of that stuff, yeah. So all of us, the professional astronauts, you know, the people who do that around the world, generally come from a technical background, engineering, science, medicine. It could be all kinds of anything. But, like, you know, kind of understanding technical issues and be able to solve problems, that's part of it. The other part of it is, when you talk about training, is some adventurous stuff, you know,
right.
flying in jets, which was awesome. I mean, I was a civilian, so
didn't
I
didn't have to pilot it? You just
No, what it was for our job, we had test pilots and instructor pilots that would fly the front seat of the training jet, and we would fly in the back seat. So we could do all the flying. But we couldn't land or take off. But other than that, we could do the flying. But I have about 1,000 hours in a T-38, which is a high-performance jet, which was a whole new world for me, that aviation.
Take me through, like, your first, what was it called, like, flight into orbit? Outer, okay, like, are you mentally, where are you at mentally? Well,
my first one happened in the middle of the night. We had our launch, you know, depending on the day you launch, there's a different window that you can get to where you want to go. So the first launch was we were taking off at like 5 a.m. So we got out to the launch pad at about 2 in the morning. So middle of the night. And the first thing I noticed looking around the spaceship, there's nobody there. And what had happened, they put fuel in the tank of the space shuttle. And so once they do that, they basically have a bomb sitting there. So they clear the areas. Like, where'd everybody go? Usually there's like 1,000 guys working on it. So no, there's no, it's like deserted. And there's smoke coming off of the spaceship. It's just water vapor, and it's making these really hideous noises. I think it was like the cryogenic fuel going through the pump. So it sounds like it's moaning. It's brightly lit, and it looked like it was alive, and it looked like a beast. And so out of all these years since I was a little kid dreaming of this day, you know, it kind of hit me. Maybe this wasn't such a good idea.
Yeah, get the hell out of there.
But by that time, it's too late, Sal, because even if I ran for it, they would have run me down and put me on.
So you had to get in that thing?
But once I got, you know, the thing about it, you talked about the training, and it's kind of like whatever you do, right? Getting on the news, on the radio, doing what you do, you know, it scared a crap out of a lot of people. Maybe it even did you when you started.
Right, I used to fear public speaking.
But you get used to it, right? You get trained, and it's the same thing with anything. You know, whether it's baseball or whatever it might be, they train us so well that it almost seems normal, and you start building up trust in what's going on. So, you know, I had trust in my equipment, and trust in my training, and trust in my team. We're all there together, and that's another big part of your training is learning how to be part of a team. And a lot of that you learn in sports, right? When we're kids growing up and playing sports, that's what it was like as an astronaut. Is that it's all about the mission, it's all about what we're trying to accomplish, and they actually train you as a team to solve problems. And so when I remembered that, I was okay. And once I got inside the spaceship, I was fine.
What was the best mission that you've been on?
I've been on two really good ones. Both were to the. I've only been on two total. Every mission is a good mission.
Okay.
The one that I really enjoyed more was my second one. I went to the Hubble Space Telescope twice, and I was a spacewalker two times. I think the reason I like
now, what does that mean, spacewalker?
So spacewalk means you get into a spacesuit and into an airlock, and then you go outside of the spaceship and move around, either on the end of the robot arm or with your hands as you're what we call translating around
to the moon.
No moon.
Okay, no.
They haven't
moon.
Done
okay.
that since 1972.
Okay. All right,
so,
all right.
But hopefully soon we're going to send people back there. But okay. No. This is just my mission is with Hubble. So in my era of being an astronaut, they're still going to the space station. So some of my colleagues went to the space station, and a smaller number of us were lucky enough to go to the Hubble. So I was like a repair person. So we went and fixed the telescope. Hubble takes all these amazing images and makes all these discoveries, and it was designed so that you could take things out and put new stuff in and work on it during a spacewalk. And so we were like repairmen. We're like, someone is coming in, or, you know, if you're fixing your car, or your washing machine, or whatever it is, we kind of did that. You know, we had tools, and we had very fancy clothes, and a great view of the Earth and all that when we were doing it. But we were repair people in space is what our job was.
We're talking with astronaut Mike Massimino here at the Joe Torre Safe at Home Celebrity Golf and Tennis Classic here. I'm going to be honest with you and the audience. So when Joe introduced me to you, and he's like, oh, he repaired the Hubble telescope.
Yeah.
I swear to you, you know what my first thought was? Something with Carl Hubble and the Giants.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, Carl Hubble.
There's another guy.
Yeah. So that's my
thing. This is another guy. His name was Edwin Hubble.
Okay. Well, all right. We're
getting came up with the Big Bang Theory, not the TV show, but the, you know, the theory of the universe.
And one of the cool things Mike just showed me during the break here with Joe Torre was the picture that you took of his. So he gave you his 2000 World Series ring, which I would like to launch into outer space and keep it there, being a Met fan.
Actually, I flew something. I flew something else for Joe, and I had just met him, and I couldn't get anything. It was too late to get things on board, so I took in my notebook an insignia that I presented to him of the Dodgers, because he was managing the Dodgers at the time. The ring you talk about was taken into space by my buddy Garrett Reisman, who's a Yankee fan, who flew dirt from Yankee Stadium in space. I flew the home plate from Shea Stadium as the two stadiums.
And what were you guys doing with it? Just to take it there and bring
just
it back?
Well, I'm such a fan, Sal. Right? So my first flight, I flew a jersey for John Franco.
Okay.
And so I, you know, started a relationship with the Mets and got to know Jay Horowitz and Ethan Wilson and that whole group of folks. They're wonderful people. And so that's what I did in my first flight. My second flight happened in 09. It was supposed to happen in 08. We got delayed a bit. In 08, I think 08 was the last season they played at Shea.
Yes.
So I called Jay up and I said, hey, Jay, you know, my friend of mine is taking dirt from Yankee Stadium. And he says, yeah, I heard about that, Mike. We can do better than dirt. Would you like a home plate? So they shipped me a home plate.
Awesome.
It was from the 07 season. And we were able to take that with us. But it's just
you should have left that there. 07, the collapse.
Well, you know what? It's interesting you mentioned that, because when they sent me the plate, right, it had the dates on it, and it was at the end of the season, and my son, who was probably about 13 at the time, says, oh, I don't know, Dad, if we should fly this. This one was, you know, this was when they collapsed. But, you know, we took that with us just as a way to pay tribute to the Mets and you know, my interest in baseball.
Did you watch, like, Interstellar or Armageddon? Have you seen those movies?
Yeah, I've seen them. They're Interstellar is kind of complicated, man. I've seen that about three times.
Is that's the one with Matt Damon?
No, the one with Matt Damon was The Martian.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got it mixed up. What was Interstellar? Was that a space
Interstellar
one?
Had Matthew McConaughey in it, and he's
was a space one, or
that
not?
Was a space one, but kind of in the future.
Okay, yeah, but I remember.
Yeah,
the
I love space movies.
The Martian.
The Martian's a good one.
Armageddon, obviously tough ending. We don't.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah,
but like that's what I think of when I think of astronauts, and you're like a real life, like you get it.
Yeah, see, that's why I always like those movies. Sal, like people say, oh, do you care if they're realistic? I really don't care as long as the astronaut looks cool, because people, you know, they're going to see that thing, right? They go, oh. Astronauts are all cool and they're all fit and everything, and we're not necessarily like that, but that's what people think. So as long as they're cool in a movie, I'm good with it.
You still have like your suits or helmets for memorabilia?
Well, no, it's a government program, so they take that stuff back. you can have a couple things with you. Like sometimes I have a watch that I took with me that I wear once in a while. Different items you have with you. But no, the official equipment, that's expensive. They want that stuff back.
Understood.
Yeah. It's a government program.
Is it weird, like, going to the bathroom in outer space?
Yeah, nah. It's one thing you kind of fear that, you know? Like, you're worried about, like, how's that going to go?
Either way, I mean.
Stuff floats, though. So, you know. And there are certain things that could really destroy your mission.
Is there a bathroom up there?
Oh, no, yeah, no. There's a bathroom up there for sure. Yeah,
but like,
absolutely. Yeah.
But, like, where?
Yeah,
where's
so
the toilet?
You have a commode. No. Okay. It's a commode. We call it the WCS, so you don't call it a toilet. Like, if they say, hey, we have trouble with the toilet, you know, and you say that to the ground, someone might hear that and worry. But if you say the WCS, people don't know what that means. So it's the waste contamination system.
Okay.
And it's a toilet and a hose to pee in, more or less.
Okay.
On the shuttle, they would collect the urine, and then it would get dumped. On the space station, they collect the urine, and then they clean it and purify it, and you drink it.
You had to do that?
No, I wasn't on the space station, but I've drank that water out of that system on Earth, and it tastes fine. As my friend Don Pettit would say, who's an astronaut, he says, today's coffee is tomorrow's coffee. We'll see it again.
Oh, what's the most challenging thing that you've had to endure as an astronaut?
I think for me was learning how to make mistakes. You know, like in sports, they tell you know, forget about your mistakes, have a short memory, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you can't get in a game, you can't do that. You know, you make a mistake, you got to move on. The game's still going on. And the same thing with being an astronaut, I found that things would inevitably go wrong. You'd make mistakes. And what I used was something I used to call the 30-second rule, where you give yourself 30 seconds of regret to beat yourself up and then move on. But I found that to be one of the more, because you can't just wallow in the misery. You got to keep going. And then some of the other things that were challenging for me was a lot of this high adventure stuff. Like I don't like heights, And I was put in situations where, you know, it was a little sporty for me. And I was a civilian. I wasn't a military guy. So it kind of put me, I was out of my comfort zone during a lot of the high adventure training. So those were probably the most difficult things.
And you're retired now? No more?
I left NASA 10 years ago. I teach now at the engineering school at Columbia University. So
okay.
I moved back to New York.
I used to broadcast the football games there. And basketball.
Oh, cool. Yes, I've listened to you doing that. You do a good job with that. I love going to those games and the basketball games as much as I can. Yes, that's where I am now.
All right, last one for you. Yeah. Talking with Mike Massimino. Pleasure to get to meet you have this conversation with you.
Yeah.
Tougher to be an astronaut or a Mets fan?
I think I don't know how to answer that, I guess. I really love both. I think that being an astronaut was a very challenging job, but it was my job, right? It was my profession. So I had a little more skin in the game there. Being a Mets fan, it's more of an enjoyment thing. I try to enjoy it. And I think I'm really happy with the way the team is headed now with their ownership and David Stearns, if he's a GM or president or whatever his.
Yep.
I think we're in good hands there. And that manager and the players they have.
You going Saturday? David Wright?
No, we're out of town, unfortunately.
Okay.
I went to his last game, though.
Okay.
I went to his last when he played that last game for like an inning or two.
Right.
I was there, but he was very nice. I got to meet him. He wouldn't remember me because we weren't really introduced, but I was at a game once with my kids, and people have a lot of these kind of stories, I'm sure, that encountered him, of how nice he was with the kids and everybody when he was playing. So I'm very happy for him.
Mike? Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Pleasure meeting you.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, next year we'll have it again. Fun.
Oh, man.
I'm going to do my homework this time and then maybe get into a little
great.
More detail.
No, you're great.
I don't know anything about an astronaut, but it's like, wow, this is cool.
I love listening to you. No matter where I am in the country, if I was in space, I'd be listening to you up there, too. Because, you get on the app and you can get the replay.
Come on. I want to go up there, take the Odyssey app up there, and you can say you listen to Sal on the Fan.
That's a reason to go back, but I don't have many others. So I think... Yeah, I think we might just have to listen to you from where I am on Earth.
Fair enough. So.